Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Elder, and today our guest has 16 years of law enforcement analysis experience with Bellevue Police Department and the Washington State Fusion Center. She has a PhD studying women and white-collar crime. She's here to talk about, among other things, testifying and the role of the analyst in a fusion center. Please welcome Shauna Gibson. Shauna, how we doing?
Good. Thank you, Jason. Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited to be here with you today.
Good. And how is the weather in Washington State these days?
Well, it's fall, so it's rainy. So if you like the rain and you like differences every day, every 5 minutes, it's the perfect weather for all of us Northwesterners who like a little variety in our day.
Let's get started here. How did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
You know, I was thinking about this, and I know that a lot of your guests say by accident, but I'd like to think that it was accidentally on purpose. So you never really know what the shape of your life is going to be like until you actually start living it. And when I was young girl, I always knew I was interested in crime and serial killers and all that kind of stuff. And I was young many, many years ago before it was cool. And there was TV shows about it. But it was kind of always an interest of mine. And I got to college and my dad was saying, you know, you should study business. And I realized I couldn't do accounting very well at all. And so I just kind of fumbled around until I landed on psychology. And I thought that was really great, but I still had the criminal justice kind of bug. And so I didn't really know how the things fit together. And then I had read a book by Jonathan Kellerman, and he had a protagonist in his book named Alex Delaware. And Alex Delaware was a child psychologist who helped law enforcement. Mm-hmm. And I remember the light bulb went off and I went, oh my gosh, these are the two things I need to do. I need to do psychology, which is a passion, and I need to do law enforcement, which is a passion. You know, so it was a novel, right? I didn't even know if you could do these two things. It was just something that I found. I was just like, hey, this looks like fun. I want to do this thing. So I kind of fumbled my way through it, figuring out how I was going to marry up these two things that I had. And I eventually, you know, I was in my undergrad, and I come across forensic psychology, or you could actually do a JD and a PhD, one in law and one in psychology. And I was like, there it is. That's what it is. So I kind of figured out how do I do this thing? And I had some really good mentors in college who said, you know, I know you really want to do this, but just in case you don't get into a PhD program, have a master's program in your pocket, just in case, because I really wasn't that great at taking standardized tests. I mean, I was a great student, you know, I was really driven and all that kind of good stuff, but, you know, standardized tests just are not my thing. I took that advice. And so for all of you young people out there who are looking to see, always have a master's program in your pocket, just in case you don't get into that PhD program, because it gets you along the way, right? It helps you in that path. And so I did, and I had found a master's program at John Jay College of Criminal Justice for Forensic Psychology in New York City. And it was one of those where I hadn't ever been east of the Mississippi, so I had no idea what I was doing. I grew up in a very small town, and I had just been in California doing my undergrad. And so I was hoping to go to Simon Fraser. That was my dream up in BC. I was thought that's really what I want to do. But as life would have it, I didn't get into any of my PhD programs, but the master's program came through. My roommate at the time, I told her, oh my gosh, look, I'm going to New York City. And then she decided to tell me that that's where Wall Street was. And I was like, really? That's where Wall Street is? And she's like, yeah. And I was like, oh my gosh. And I'm like, what else is there? She's like, well, that's where they like film MTV. And I'm like, stop it. And so I just was kind of a sheltered person. I didn't really look out of my four windows very much. And so I really had no idea what I was getting myself into. I mean, really, if to give you a perspective, and I'm not exaggerating, where I grew up was a town of 800 people in one paved street. Wow. And Yeah, so it was a huge difference for me. So I said, okay, well, I'm going to New York City and I'm going to go study forensic psychology. I don't know what I'm going to do with this thing, but I'm going to do that. And so all of my family, very, very, very nervous for me, said, okay, go do it. And so this was in the late 90s. And so I went there and I realized that, oh, master's programs are a lot more expensive than undergrad. Mm-hmm. And so I figured out how to do it in about 3 semesters so that I wasn't quite so poor. And I had an amazing experience, but I first got there and there was a Newsweek article and it was John Jay College of Criminal Justice, number one criminal justice university in the nation. And, you know, if you want to be that cool guy in the bar, tell him you're studying forensic psychology because this is the up and coming thing. And I was mm-hmm. like, wow, this is like the only time I've ever been cool in my life. So right on. And I mean, you know, so I was like, okay. So I finished it. And during that process, I got to do an internship. So I really wasn't into writing. I was probably more of a PsyD person because writing wasn't my thing. I took an internship and I got to be a therapist for domestic violence offenders. So I know this is a long-winded explanation, but you know, it's kind of the way I got there. Yeah. And I found out that I was very passionate about that. And I loved how it all sort of built together. And so finished up, came back to Washington and was living with my grandmother and trying to figure out how to get a job and, you know, kind of in that in-between space of life. And I landed on as a therapist for a domestic violence group, which I really loved doing, working with the offenders and kind of helping them build better relationships. And, you know, because those are the most important parts of our lives is, you know, getting people, you know, being in healthy relationships. And if you can help people do that, you know, I think that's really gratifying. So did that. As you know, life would have it, I lost my job about a year later, wasn't really sure what I was going to do with my life. I had a cousin, I come from an Italian family. I had a cousin who said, hey, you want to go to Europe? It's, you know, and learn about European expansion. And I'm thinking, I don't know where European expanding to. So, you know, I'm like, sure. I don't know what else I'm going to do. I haven't gotten a job yet. So I jumped on that bandwagon and I said, sure, I'll go. And I had right before that, I had set up like I'd made my New Year's resolution. And I said, this year I want to go to France. I'd never had a passport before. So I wanted to, and this was in my late 20s. And so I wanted to see a bit of the world. And this was before I lost my job. So I jumped on that, you know, one door closes, another one opens, took that opportunity. And then as I was researching and getting ready for the trip, I reached out to one of the professors who was putting together this program had said, are you interested in doing anything else like an internship? And I've always loved to work and learn. And I said, sure. She's like, well, what are some of your interests? And I said, well, you know, criminology is a big one. Psychology is another one. And she said, well, there's this scholarship for people for Trentini al Mondo. So it's people that come from this part of Italy. And they actually have a PhD program in criminology through the University of Trento. Would you want an internship there? And then maybe you could apply for a PhD. And I was like, what? Yes, of course. And I said, oh, sure. And she's like, you know, I can't guarantee that you'll get in. And I'm like, no, that's all right. And so I just said, yeah, I'll jump on that. Because basically at that point, my only criteria for a PhD, I mean, I didn't really care what it was going to be. And I just didn't want to pay for it. And so that was basically my bar. So I went there, didn't know whether I was going to Italy for 3 months or 3 years. And I, you know, basically put my whole world in a storage shed and got on a plane, had never been out of the US, kind of like New York. And I said, okay, let the universe take me where it's going to take me. And I got there and, you know, as luck would have it, I managed to show my worth and got into the PhD program. And European PhDs are are slightly different than American PhDs, not terribly, but you can't be ABD. Basically, it's a 3-year program. And so you have to complete everything within the 3 years, and then you get a 1-year extension. And if you don't have your dissertation written by the end of that, you kind of are washed out. So they have some tighter timelines than we do, but you work throughout the whole year.
Yeah. Real quick. What did you say? ABD?
All but your dissertation.
Oh,
so,
okay. All right.
Yeah. You've done everything but your dissertation. There's a lot of, you know, unfortunately in America that, you know, you can be ABD where you've done everything. Mm-hmm. But your dissertation, which is a lot of work in America. It's still a lot of work, but you know, and they don't really have that. It doesn't really exist and European PhDs. So back up a little bit. When I landed in Italy on the 5th of September, 2001. And of course, as we all know, 9/11 happened 6 days later. Didn't speak the language, didn't know where I was, completely outside of America, watching some, you know, something, one of the biggest events in all of our lifetime, quite frankly, occur and really be a change. And so I watched America change from another country, which I think was really, it definitely impacted me in a lot of different ways. And so during my PhD, I kind of, you know, was going through all of that and finally finished it up, came back to America and was like, okay, now what? Law enforcement had changed, you know, the face of law enforcement had absolutely changed. And I didn't really know what I was going to do. I wasn't sure I was going to be a therapist anymore. I didn't know if I was going to be in, you know, academia, because now I have this PhD and it's a very academic thing. And so I was just sort of adrift. I kind of started looking at, you know, job announcements and seeing this thing about analysts. And I was like, and at that time, you know, I was kind of looking at things in the federal side, and they do this knowledge, skills, and experience, KSEs. You know, so you really look and see, how does my skill set transition into these other jobs? You know, what can I pull from in my life that would show me, you know, that I'm able to apply for these positions? And I wasn't having much luck, and I was quickly running out of money, and I was living with my grandmother again, because she was this angel that always kind of kept me between my degrees. I was headed down to Portland, and on the way I was going to hit a couple of career fairs. And at this point I'm like hungry, right? I have like $2,000 left to my name. And I'm just like, I just want a job. You know, so much for this. I had gone to a couple of interviews. One of them was at a college, and I didn't really have the experience. And I was like, you know, it was a college near one of the bases. And they said, you know, what are you going to be able to teach all of these, you know, returning vets that are going to take your class here, you know, that are coming, that are staying at JBLM? And I was like, you know, the best instructors I ever had life experience. And I really didn't think I could teach much of anything at that point. You know, I could teach the academics, but I couldn't really teach the life or teach, you know, the experience. And I grew up in a very working class family who had a lot of experience and valued that. And that's, you know, just kind of transitioned. So I was like, you know, I need to get experience. And that's kind of where my heart was sending me. So I went to this career fair, and it was all for law enforcement. And so it was everybody hiring officers for a whole host of different agencies throughout the Northwest. And I think it was probably at our training center in Burien. And I kept going through, and I was like, how do I get into intelligence? Like this, I'd never really even talked to a cop other than, you know, getting pulled over and getting a ticket or something. And so I really didn't know what I was getting into. And so it was just me and not really, you know, just being me. And so I'd go up to him, like, finally, the last one, because I realized that you have to be sworn in order to do intelligence in local law enforcement in a lot of these positions. And so nobody really knew what to do with me. And so I finally walked up to this guy and I said, you know what? I'm not having much luck here. So I'll tell you what I got. You tell me what you got. And he's just looking at me going, where did she fall from? And I explain, you know, this, I have this PhD and this is what I want to do. And he's like, you know, I think there's this like data entry thing that I heard about at this meeting that I went to recently. You know, maybe you want to talk to this guy who's looking for people to do this. And I was just like, that sounds fantastic. Whatever I can do to, you know, feed myself and, you know, get a job. So he gives me the name of the guy who is at the lieutenant at Everett, who is hiring these positions. And so I reach out to him and just kind of, you know, oblivious as I am, you know, didn't realize that I needed to call him by his lieutenant name or anything like that. And I'm like, hi, dear Steve. You know? And so I tell him, I'm like, this is what I got. I heard about this thing. And then he explains to me that I need to get a business license because they're basically hiring contractors for the Fusion Center. And he sends me the RFP, the request for proposals. And I was like, oh my God, this isn't data entry. This is everything that I ever wanted to do. Oh, and wow. Yeah. And it was just like this dream come true. And it was just this last ditch effort talking to this guy, you know, he was a sergeant at Marysville PD. I'll never forget him. He said, yeah, I think it's this data entry gig. and take, you know, basically running with it and getting the position. And it was amazing. And they basically said, okay, you're hired, you know, we've approved your RFP. You're now going to be a contractor for the Washington State Fusion Center. You're hired. And I said, great. And I got there and they put me in an office with a computer.
Wow.
And I was like, okay, now what? So that was kind of how I got there. Then I didn't know what to do because I had this computer and an office and my dream job. So I was kind of left at that point.
Man, well, that is quite a long, strange trip you just took us on. Very interesting, though. So a couple of follow-up questions before we get to your time there in the Fusion Center. So when you look back now, what are some particular memories that stick out about your time in New York City?
Oh, gosh. I think probably there was my first trip to the Met was one that really stuck out because I had just finished up this class in like Emergence of Civilization. And it was talking about things that happened eons ago, right? Mm-hmm. And then I'm in the Met and I get there and I spend like 4 hours on the first floor and thinking I'd seen the whole thing. And I get home and I tell my roommate and she's like, didn't you get to this floor? Or this floor? And she's telling me all these things that I missed. And it was so overwhelming and so big. And it was one of those, I think I realized how really small and insignificant you become in a city that's just so massive on so many scales. And having grown up in such a small town, like you don't feel insignificant in a small town. Everybody knows your business. You know everybody else's business. You know everything about everything there. You know, you get very good at that space. And in a city like that, you don't get good in that space. And learning and going around the different boroughs, one of the other things I got to do while I was there was interview senior citizens to find out the efficacy of the senior citizen centers throughout all of the 5 boroughs in Manhattan, so the Bronx and the Queens and all that. And so I got to take the train up to some neighborhoods that a lot of people would be like, that's probably not the safest neighborhood to go into, and talk to these people that just had never left that little corner of the world. And it was really eye-opening just how many different people inhabit this planet. And it was just really cool to meet them and, you know, to listen to their stories and find out what was really meaningful to them. So it was pretty cool.
Then your time as a therapist, then you are working with men who had just been part of a domestic violence situation.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe go over a little bit about what you learned, or maybe if there's stuff that are misnomers when it comes to males and domestic violence, because that's certainly a fascinating topic.
So when I think about that time, I did 2 different things. You know, you do the intake where you do the interview of the offenders and they would tell you their event and kind of their history. And it's really about a belief system, right? It's domestic violence is very much about choices and belief systems and it's a power and control issue. And it's not limited to men, of course. It just happens to be because of, I think, the belief system that we have in our society can engender some of those belief systems and then make some men believe that that's what they can do. But I've also, you know, it also happens in same-sex relationships. It doesn't matter. You know, it's not necessarily a gender thing that goes along with an XY. It oftentimes goes with our role in a relationship. Because I did an interview and it was a female offender, and the things that she said about her partner and why she did what she did to her partner were identical to the things that many of my male clients had said that they had done to their partner and why. And so it's very much a belief system. And so when you're working with these people who have made these choices, you're really breaking down that belief system and giving them tools to basically slow down that train, right? Because what happens is you kind of get into this space where you can't think straight, and then they make these series of bad choices. But all of us have gotten in those situations where we can't think straight and we make different choices. And, you know, you think about, you know, what's the worst thing, and you're like, yeah, I'd come in and I'd do this terrible thing that, you know, this person is engaged in this terrible activity and I would I'd go out to the garage and I'd get my gun and go, you know, come back and kill them. Well, most people would be like, no, I'd go out to the garage, take a deep breath and keep walking and probably say, not again, right? So most of us have that. But, you know, so it's about getting them to stop in that moment when they can make that choice about assaulting or degrading or making that other person feel bad, and teaching them how to, you know, giving them that skill set to say, you know what, let me, I need to take care of me for a moment, and I'm about ready to do something bad. And so one of the biggest things we taught people was how to take that time out and how to breathe and how to just slow the train down. So that relationship had a moment to have the struggles, because we all have struggles in our relationship, have the struggle, see it for what it is, and then come back and really think through what your response is going to be to that struggle. So being able to equip people with that and seeing, you know, we weren't always successful, but for some of the people that we were successful for, I mean, it was really rewarding, because, you know, especially when you got to talk to the victims and the victims would say, no, he's really changing. He's, you know, we had a really tough time the other day and he stopped and he left the house and he came back and we had this really great conversation and, you know, we're getting closer. And it's really, and so it was really great to hear those kinds of stories.
All right. Well, let's get to your days in there at the Fusion Center. So you're starting there. As you mentioned before, they sat you down, gave you a computer, and just said, go. And so take us back to those first couple of weeks, what your thoughts are now and some of the issues you had, and how you overcame them.
So I think there were some things that were already set up. So that was really nice. You know, we had this weekly meeting where everybody came in and shared information in person. And so the way I started, I was like, well, since I didn't know where I was going with it, I looked at it and I said, well, why do I have this position? Well, it's because of 9/11. So I went and bought the 9/11 commission report and read it cover to cover, just to try and identify what exactly they were trying to get at with the standing up at the Fusion Centers. And so I was able to take that and then sit through these meetings and then identify these people and say, okay, what are they trying to accomplish here? They're trying to share information. And in that space, I realized that the biggest thing was, how do you get information out of the pockets of the patrol officer into the intel world, into the intelligence community, or even into your agency, so that people all have visibility about the issues that are going on? So that was kind of where I started and what I did. And I remember making friends with a good detective in Arlington, and he said, you know, I have this big case on ID theft. Why don't you come read it and see what you can do with it? And I didn't have any idea what an analyst did with that stuff. So I came in and read it and started highlighting the names and the phone numbers of all of the key players. And it just helped get me used to reading names and reading police reports and figuring out how it all connected together. Because you quickly realize, it took me a couple of years to realize, but there's not a terrorist behind every tree. And you know, most of law enforcement is, you know, burglaries, motor vehicle prowls, you know, those kinds of things. And so as an analyst, the biggest stuff that we can do is really help that patrol officer. And as we help those patrol officers do their jobs better, they're going to be more inclined to share information because they see value in what it is that we do. And so I just kind of approached it from that perspective of, how do I help that patrol officer do his job the best? That's then going to lead to really great investigations. And eventually, and amidst all of that work that we do every day, I will have faith that we will find the terrorist group or the large drug trafficking organization, because we're doing good work and we're all on the same mission. And so I just sort of approached it from that. And that was really my passion from the beginning. And so putting together a weekly bulletin of, you know, just everyday crime, of this is what's going on, and then sharing that information and really supporting that information sharing environment. And I use the word information specifically. It wasn't intelligence, it's information. Sure. It's just, you know, it's just raw, you know, this is what happens. This is who we're trying to identify. This is what's going on. This is the series of whatever that we've had. And just getting everybody on that same page. And so that was really how I spent my time at the Fusion Center, because I wasn't actually inside the Fusion Center doing threat assessments. I was at a local agency supporting that local agency and trying to build up their analytical capacity, because I quickly realized that if I needed information, yes, I had my patrol officers and I had the detectives, but the other people that I sort of, you know, about a year or so into it, I realized, I'm like, why aren't there other analysts around? Like, what are their crime analysts? You know, there's like these crime analysts that I keep hearing this word, you know, I keep hearing this thing. What are these, who are these people? And I bet you they know a lot about what's going on in their agency because they have, they're sitting in the middle of their data, right? They've got to know what's going on. And so I kept trying to figure out, well, who are these people? Because I would see the bulletins come out and, you know, there was, the way I learned was just by seeing what people produced. And Cynthia Konechny at King County, amazing crime analyst that does a lot of work for Fiat and stuff like that. And I just thought she was my go-by early on because I just loved the work that she did. And she seemed to know everything about everything. And I was like, I need to be like her because she knows everything. So, you know, that was sort of my person that I followed. I don't know that she knows that I followed her quite like that. She probably thinks I'm a stalker if I did, but she's somebody I really appreciated.
It's 15 years ago. Yeah, it's all good now.
She's right. She still knows. I think I told her. I still work with her very closely and I still feel the same. So.
So then you're stationed at a particular department. Do you have access to all the data? Are you getting the background checks and everything else that's needed to be able to access all this data?
Yeah. So I had access to all the data I had access to all the data for, like, we had Snowpack. So a lot of the agencies up here are sort of on those collaboration, you know, they all kind of are on the same sort of CAD environment. And so I learned how to get the data there. So I got to do a little bit of, see a little bit of the data for the crime analysis side of the house, but I was really much more towards the intel. So I was trying to do more work on international and domestic terrorism and organized crime and gangs. So that was really where I was focused. But I realized that the way I was a better intel analyst when I knew what was going on at the local level, right? If we could build these information sharing meetings with the school resource officers who interacted with the kids who were sort of exposed to the gangs and trying to get into the gang life, it made me a better intel analyst because I really had my thumb on the heartbeat of the information. So I was really able to see the power of both sides of that analytical coin and how important it was that the two things worked together.
Okay. So this brings us to your first analyst badge story. For those that may be new to the show, the analyst badge story is the career-defining case or project that an analyst works. Your first analyst badge story deals with a robbery and you really getting the experience of seeing how analysis works.
Yeah. So this was, I dubbed him my bring your own bag robbery guy. So I love robberies. I love working robbery series because as I tell my officers, everybody knows when they're robbed. Not everybody knows when they get burglarized. So when you get robbed, you can do a lot of really great analysis on it, right? So you can do some some pretty good predictive policing. So this was my first time out of the gate where I got to really work on, you know, a series and do some of that predictive policing. And he had a very clear pattern. He would hit multiple places in a night. And I didn't really understand how patrol, like, talked to each other or they listened to each other's air or anything. You know, I didn't really understand how all of the information flowed in patrol. And so I put out this bulletin. I said, hey, I think based on his pattern, I think he's going to hit in a couple of days. Patrol, please monitor these, you know, various convenience stores. And so there was a couple of, I think it was new officers, newish officers in another small town who they were all listening. They were aware that this robbery was occurring so that they could respond. And they said, well, let's go sit up on this convenience store in this small town kind of right outside of where I was working. And sure enough, the guy gets out of his robbery mobile, puts on his robbery outfit, takes his bag out of his pocket and heads in. And I think I can just envision these two guys like hitting each other, going, oh my God, that's him. That's him. He's he's hitting right now. And so they got to then catch him in the act. And then the next day we had our information sharing meeting and the detectives from that agency came in and they're like, they got him. And they tell me the story and I didn't quite click in. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's so amazing. And these guys were so excited. And it was because they were reading the work that I was putting out. And I don't think that there's anything more gratifying in our job as analysts to know that people consume the product that you put effort, time and effort into and used it. And it actually you know, saved somebody from being a victim. I mean, there's just nothing more gratifying than that's why we're in this business. And, you know, it's, I'm still amazed when I tell that story and I tell that story to all my new officers, you know, how patrol officers can consume so much information. I mean, I really do think I tell them this all the time. I don't say it lightly. They really, that's where the magic happens in law enforcement, in my opinion, is at patrol, because what those guys and gals do monitoring, you know, getting, having the dispatchers in their ear and monitoring their MDCs and just doing all of the work that they do, and then consuming the information that we then, more information that we put out, and then still finding, you know, still managing to catch the bad guy. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how we catch the bad guy. It's pretty cool. And being able to support that is just one of the things that just keeps me in the business. I just love it.
Patrol likes to hunt, right? They want to get information that allows them to go search the canvas, so to speak, and hunt down some folks. I think on patrol side, you know, they get frustrated. There's all this information out there, but they'll say, well, what am I supposed to do with that? That's not mm-hmm. necessarily actionable. Right. We always talk about intelligence as being actionable. What am I supposed to do with that information? But there are times where, hey, you can give them really good, sound information that has the potential to be actionable, and they can have these great results that you just talked about.
Yeah. It's the so what, you know, it's always whenever I forward something or send something or create something, I never hit send before I'm able to say, so what? What do I want patrol? What do I want my audience to do with this information? You know, is it a map? Well, so what? You know, if they know they took all those reports, you know, so what about that map of motor vehicle prowls? You know, what's important that they should know about that? You know, otherwise it's just noise, you know, and we're inundated with information. So trying to, you know, our value add as analysts is to make sense of it.
When I first started my career in law enforcement, I was working for the Washington Baltimore HIDA, and I was stationed at Baltimore Police Department. And there was one of three HIDA analysts that were stationed at Baltimore Police Department. And I always felt when I worked there that I was part of the team, but I wasn't part of the team. Certainly, I had tasks, I had a piece of the pie, so to speak, in terms of my responsibilities for the work that I had to do. But I wasn't, you know, I wasn't a Baltimore Police Department employee. I wasn't a Baltimore City employee. I didn't grow up in Baltimore. There was just a little bit of it. Always felt like a little bit of disconnect. And so in your situation here, you're coming in as a contractor, and you're on your own. There's not even another, you know, you're not working for another company where there's another, you have coworkers. You are literally on your own business per se.
You know, I think that's a good question. I think there was a little bit of that. There were three of us in there. So there was two other contractors, and we were all for the Fusion Center. And the way that they were sort of reimagining the Fusion Center here was we all had our own little region. So we were all these different Homeland Security regions. And so there was three of us that were doing this work. And so I felt like I had that little team, but these guys were, one was a retired SPD detective and the other one was a retired NCIS agent. And so we all had these very different backgrounds. And so they were sort of showing me the ropes of law enforcement. So I felt like I had my own little team there, because it felt like we were very much trying to build this information sharing environment. And we were just happened to be co-located with this agency. But the longer I was with the agency, the more I did feel like I was part of the team. So we got to go to the Christmas stuff. I did feel like I was very much my own thing, because I was more about my mission and trying to build that information sharing environment and having, you know, that agency support that. And that agency was fantastic at supporting that. I mean, they were just like, yes, we want this. And it's still going on today. Like, they still have that information sharing bulletin that is a weekly thing. And it was, I mean, it really took off, and that agency is super supportive of it. So, but it was always very clear, right? I mean, you have to as well, for like tax reasons, you have to say, nope, you can't, because you can't treat people in that role as employees, because they're not, they're contractors. And so you can't really do a lot of, you can't really dictate a lot. So it was definitely different. And I know when I finally got to Bellevue, I was like, oh, so that's what it's like. And Yeah, so it was definitely, it was when I got, I really noticed the difference when I got to Bellevue was of being sort of part of the team and then not, and kind of being on the outside building your own thing.
Hi, I'm Joanne. I'm a crime analyst with the Saskatoon Police Service. The public service announcement that I have is for, especially for junior analysts, but also senior analysts, just be true to yourself and recognize that the police culture that you're in shouldn't necessarily shape who you are, but you have something to bring towards your service as a benefit as well.
Hi, I'm Jamie Roush, and I have a really important public service announcement for you. No one wants to hear your conversation on speakerphone in a public restroom. It's awkward for you and for anyone else who comes in. No conversation is that important.
So let's talk about the role of analysis in a fusion center and maybe go over from your perspective some of the do's and don'ts for what an analyst should and shouldn't do.
You know, I think fusion centers have gone through a huge, I guess, renaissance is probably a good word, right? I think when they first started, if you saw one fusion center, you saw one fusion center. And it's a very common phrase, right? That they're all a little bit different. And at first I thought maybe that was bad, but then you realize they're all a little bit different because the needs of the state, the urban area, are different. And so those fusion centers are really trying to fill that need, which is important. And the fusion center, I think, as time goes on and they get more utilized, they become more important. And I know our fusion center, you know, does a lot of work to just sort of organize or does a lot of like threat assessments for large events. And that's a lot of things that, you know, I think as a local agency analyst, you can do. But they just have a bigger view. And I think as a fusion center analyst, you have to have that bigger view of the threats that are being posed to whatever local area, because that's really what you're being asked is how do you encourage people to share information, encourage law enforcement, private sector, and everybody to share information so that they can be as, so they can share, further share that information with the intelligence community. So they really do serve that bridge function, and it's important. So I think as a, the do's and don'ts would be, you know, do encourage information sharing, however that looks, you know, don't have particular rules about, well, I can only do this or that, you know, focus on the mission. Don't do anything illegal, of course, and make sure that, you know, that you're encouraging that information sharing, because that's the mission of the Fusion Center, is to support and encourage information sharing across everybody, law enforcement, private sector, fire, you know, all of the different stakeholders that they have. So I think fusion centers have a large role to play. And I think as an analyst, you kind of have to, in a fusion center, you need to keep your eye on that bigger picture of, okay, how do I support these, you know, local agencies, companies, et cetera, in the best way possible? And I think also, how do I translate all of the information that I have access to within the fusion center? And, you know, because you do have access to a ton of information, you know, at the local level, at the state level, at the federal level, how do I translate those threats to local law enforcement, to the private sector, in order for them to take action to either gather more information for you and fill those information gaps, or to protect? So I think that's kind of the role of that analyst, is being able to figure out, how do you get information in? How do you work with it? Put it up against the wall and see what sticks, and then take it out of that space and communicate it effectively to your stakeholders. So that's what the Fusion Center analyst really should be doing.
So do you have any tips on consuming a large amount of data and then sharing it in a way that's consumable to your audience?
Be able to answer the so what in one sentence. I mean, that is my biggest thing is, you know, you're going to consume it and you're going to put it together and recognize that you may be putting together multiple products, right? That, you know, the product, if you're doing an assessment and it's a 5-page product, you know, make sure you can break it down and that you can pretty much give your elevator pitch and say what the so what is, you know, pretty quickly. So there's an event happening and there's this threat and this is what you should do about it. You need to be able to, you know, people are busy. We're just inundated with information. And as an analyst in that space where you are really the person that has the most access to the information, you have to be able to translate it, right? And you are likely the expert in whatever threat or whatever it is that you're working on. And you have to be able to say it succinctly and with clarity and make those recommendations that are meaningful, understanding what the resource limitations might be for your stakeholder. And I think that's the value add when you're in that role.
I think another thing that I struggled with, especially when I first started, is really putting myself in the shoes of the stakeholders and thinking of like a way, thinking their way. I went through the mindset of like, okay, here's the facts, X, Y, and Z, here, go. And expecting them to just almost sometimes without question, consume it and go with it. And I didn't do a very good job of seeing it from their perspective, seeing that there could be a possibility for them to say, well, so what?
Yeah. I think we all struggle with it, right? And I think that's always my big mantra. But yeah, it's sometimes it's hard to put yourself sometimes, you know, in those shoes of the stakeholder, you know, like, so what do you want me to do with this? You know, and so we have to be able to answer that question, you know, even if it's just those products are typically to warn, inform, or to mitigate, right? So mm-hmm. we're trying to mitigate a threat. We're trying to warn our stakeholders that this could be a threat, or we're informing them of something else, right? And so, but there's always, we always want somebody to do something at the end, right? If we say there's a robbery series, please, you know, patrol, please set up on convenience stores between 2 and 5. When you can put it succinctly like that for the patrol, you know, how do you also translate that ability? Because I think it's very easy to do it in a tactical way. How do we do that for those larger threat assessments that may be coming out of the Fusion Center? How do you summarize and make it that succinct for the other stakeholders? Because for patrol, it's sometimes easy. It's easy to do the actionable stuff for patrol, but it's a little bit harder on the so what's, which kind of makes you as an analyst think, okay, I have to think about the big picture, right? Because you have to think about the whole agency of, well, it's great to say we should run a bomb dog down the parade route. You don't have a bomb dog and there's no bomb dogs available. So where are you going to get it, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of, you really do have to be aware of all of your resources as an analyst and be able to tailor those recommendations to all of that.
Well, I'll just add that to the listener, someone that has an opportunity that's just starting out in analysis or looking to get their foot in the door, I feel that fusion centers are a great place to start. And
you
have so many opportunities to network with various departments in the area, local, state, and federal. And it gives you so many connections to go in various paths. And I'm actually guessing is that how you ended up in Bellevue?
That's exactly how I ended up. And I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, fusion centers are just great. It's just a great place. Because like you said, you're just exposed to so much, you know. I wouldn't have known that my passion was patrol if it hadn't been for that, you know, that experience. So, you know, I couldn't agree with you more. And that's exactly how I ended up at Bellevue. You know, I'd kind of spent my time at the Fusion Center, and I, you know, it's kind of, you know, you sort of know when it's time to move on. And I had been, I had actually talked to, there's a Redmond analyst, Craig Weary and Christina Scholl, and I was in Kirkland analyst, Christina, and we were at an event in Redmond, just kind of off time. And they said, hey, I think Bellevue was talking about hiring an analyst. And I was like, really? That's interesting. And I had, you know, really great experiences with people that were there and from the basically day one at the Fusion Center. And I just knew that Bellevue was filled with really smart, driven, great people. And, you know, and I just knew that I'd fit in, and I just really liked everybody that I interacted with there. And so I was, you know, basically the first one in line, like that annoying cartoon girl, pick me, pick me, pick me. And so doing everything I could, and, you know, and Christina really helped sort of, you know, get me in there, and we're sort of working, and it was great. I mean, Bellevue sits right next to Kirkland. So for her and Craig, it was really important to have another person in Bellevue to sort of be able to network with them. And Bellevue already had some analytical capacity. So we were just sort of, they were sort of adding to it with my position. And I was able to kind of come in and see what already existed and then just sort of augment it. It was an easy transition. I think I went to, you know, I went to the meeting that I went, the weekly meeting that I attended at my other job in the morning. And then I went to Bellevue in the afternoon. And it was, you know, it was just a really easy transition. My crazy partner, who has since retired, he was at an ILEA conference before I got hired. And I always tell the story. He looked at me, he was in the pool with his wife. And he said, "You're going to work for Bellevue one of these days." And I just remember going, "Okay, sure." And he was right. And it was,
who was this?
It was, his name was Frank Finley. He was a detective who he basically put together the weekly bulletin that he put out to a whole bunch of law enforcement, and was kind of the crime analyst detective. He was the sworn side of the house, and he monitored all the registered sex offenders. And great detective, had been there. You know, my career has been filled with these guys that have been in the business for decades. He started in LA and, you know, sworn side of the house. So they really taught me how to communicate with law enforcement. And they just really took me under their wings and taught me how to be a better analyst, how to answer that so what in the best way. And so, yeah, he told me, he's like, "One of these days you're going to work there." And I said, "Oh, I don't know about that. We'll see." I mean, I kind of secretly was hoping, of course, going, "Yeah, that would be awesome." And then when it came along, you know, I jumped at it. You didn't have to tell me twice. I was in with both feet, and they welcomed me with open arms. And they said, "You know, whatever you want to do, go for it. You're doing it." So it's a great agency. So I really can't complain.
So you were able to then carve your own path in terms of being more rigid of like, okay, you're responsible for X, Y, and Z. Sounds like they just said, "Hey, go do."
Yeah, that's pretty much it. They said, "Go do your thing. You do great work. Go figure out, you know, what it is." And so I just kind of sat back and looked and saw how everything worked. If it's not broke, don't fix it. And there was a lot of things where, you know, Frank was doing a fantastic job with communicating what was going on a weekly basis. We had another analyst who was putting, you know, kind of the stats and stuff like that. So I was able to see, okay, so what are the gaps? You know, where can I fill in? And I was able to do more of the tactical stuff and do some more of the investigative support for the detectives. And so I was really able to sort of build out some of my skill set a little bit more and just fill those gaps. You know, the gaps weren't big. So it was really, we were able to really augment and build out what today is, I think, a pretty functioning group of people. And I think we do good work. So.
All right. So this gets us to your second badge story, which deals with a big burglary ring.
That's about, again, the magic of patrol, right? So I had an officer who was going on vacation. He said, "Hey, can you take a look at this video?" And I actually did a presentation, I think, on this at one of the IACA conferences a couple of years ago. This burglary ring just lasted forever. And there was like 150 burglaries that was tied to this group. They were really good at what they did. And we just couldn't quite figure out how to, you know, break into this burglary ring. And so we had changed up the way we did business, and, you know, we did everything we could to figure out how to catch these guys, because they were able to break into these homes and be in and out inside of 3 minutes. So they were just very effective at what they were doing. Basically, the way we broke into it is another heads up patrol officer in a neighboring jurisdiction found a phone, and on it had a phone number, and he had written into his report phone number that was there, and then that underneath it was my boo. And so he had written it into the report, and we had known that this burglary was part of the larger series, and this, and it started in April, and I think this time it's like October. So for the majority of the year, this had been going on. And so one of my heads up detective, you know, we found it. One of my heads up detectives found that. And then, you know, because we were trying to brainstorm, like, how is this happening? How are these people going into these neighborhoods and nobody is seeing anything? And, you know, so we were using every tool in our toolbox. We were brainstorming. We were creative thinking. We were analysis and competing hypotheses. I mean, we were doing predictions. We were doing everything, every analytical tool I could think of, we were using, and we couldn't come up with the answer. But it was that heads up patrol guy who wrote that in his report, and then the detective who just was dogmatic about following up with it. And we eventually found him. It was a good story to the end. I mean, we didn't get our guys in jail for a long, long time, but we did get them eventually. And knowing that information sharing and really working at it, but recognizing that sometimes it's just the luck of patrol and just good gumshoe detective work that's going to get it. And, you know, whatever you can do as an analyst to support it, even if it's just keeping the spreadsheet of all of the events.
So how were you able to link all these cases together?
They had a very specific MO. So they were always happening on weekends, longer weekends, and they only took certain things. They broke in a particular way. They sent a rock through like the plate glass window, and all of the homes were in incredibly high-end neighborhoods. The way that the criminals were doing it, I mean, it just made it really hard for us to find them and to, you know, surveil them and the way that they were doing it. That's how we linked it up. And by sharing information with each other in the bulletin, because, you know, Christina had some, I had some, you know, Seattle had some, and we were able to sort of keep putting them together and making sure patrol knew what was happening. You know, even if they got sick of it, it's like version number 75, here we go again. And, you know, but they knew what was happening and everybody knew. You know, you'd walk by the patrol squad when we were in briefing and they're like, oh, another one happened last night. And what are we going to do about this? And, you know, just kind of those conversations in the halls. And
yeah. So how do you think they were picking their targets?
You know, I think it was probably because they were just really high end homes. I mean, I think that they would kind of walk around and see what was, oh, that looks like a house worth a whole lot of money. And I honestly don't know how they were doing it, but I mean, where they were hitting was always very, very specific, you know, very, you know, the neighborhoods and these are typically like very little crime neighborhoods. And so they really stuck out, you know, when you did your mapping, they stuck out like a sore thumb. Hmm.
Today, what does a typical week look like for you as an analyst?
Well, right now, we're trying to build out dashboards in order to do some automate some of the boring stuff, as one of our other analysts puts it. And Brian Salsing in Vancouver, that's what he says, always, mm-hmm. You know, automate the boring stuff. It's not the boring stuff to us, but it's what will make it easier for patrol and command to self-service, right? So we're trying to figure out how do we build out those dashboards. So right now, my typical week looks at, you know, how do we build out those dashboards? It's me and my cohort who does a lot of the admin analysis, you know, trying to talk through, you know, what's up, what's down, what series do we need to look at, what problems are we focusing on? And, you know, right now the world is awash in catalytic converter thefts. So that is always a big topic that we're always interested in. So it's like day one, I still get to kind of structure my day to best serve the agency, whatever that looks like. And so that's kind of how my day looks. It's, you know, reading reports and figuring out what's important and then making sure that I'm sharing the information that comes through. And, you know, my two career goals is not to be on the front page of a newspaper and not be on a delete list. So, so I'm trying to make sure I reach those two goals every day.
Those are two very good goals. So you actually said something the other day when we were doing the prep call that stuck with me a little bit, and it makes sense. But the way you put it stuck with me, because normally the goal of any police department, any crime analysis or intelligence analysis unit in a police department, the goal is to have less crime. But you talked about having fewer victims and that being the goal. And that particularly stuck with me because less crime goes hand in hand with fewer victims. But to put it in a way to like the goal is to have fewer victims as opposed to having less crime. So I guess, can you just talk about your philosophy in that?
Yeah, I mean, it really is, you know, because we are all about the people, right? It's a community that we serve in law enforcement. And for me, I serve the citizens of Bellevue. And I want to make sure that there are fewer people in, you know, that where they live, work, and play is as safe as it can be. And there are fewer victims because these are people. And, you know, the patrol goes out there and, you know, interacts with people sometimes on the worst day of their lives. And, you know, what we can do back here is make sure that more people have fewer worse days, right? And, mm-hmm. You know, that's why we do this is because we have a servant's heart and we want to make sure that, you know, people live, work, and play in a safe environment and can do things, and we have to be partners with them. And if you kind of take it out, you know, it's not just the numbers. There's a person behind each one of those numbers. And, you know, so making sure that we always keep that in mind, that it's the people that we're serving. And as we lower the crime, yes, we have fewer victims. And that's really, really the goal. And I can't take credit for it, because it was actually Christopher Bruce who said it in a training I went to. And it stuck with me in the same way it stuck with you. I was like, yeah, that's our goal, is to have fewer victims. That's why we do this.
Oh, I should have known it was Christopher.
I shouldn't have given him credit. I should have taken all of the credit myself, but I can't.
All right. Well, let's move on. Let's talk about testifying as an analyst. You've had an opportunity to testify and certainly have had some lessons learned and some tips and tricks that you'd like to share.
So I think testifying, it's kind of the test, right? It's testifying. And I've sort of started approaching it as very much kind of your final exam of that case that you worked on. Mm-hmm. And I think when I first did it, I sort of approached it of the, I worked on this, I know this data back and forth, I know what happened. And in Washington, they kind of get a first crack at you in a defense interview. And so that means they can pretty much ask you anything that they want. And I don't think that I performed as fantastic as I had hoped for on my first defense interview that I ever did. And I realized that, gosh, maybe, you know, the work that I do is really impactful, and could, we always talk about it, you know, whether, you know, the work that you can do can either make or break a case. And you don't really know that, but it's true. When you sit in a defense interview, it really kind of comes home and you're like, oh my goodness, yeah, the work that I did really did contribute to this case. The first defense interview I did, I don't think I was prepared as I should have. And I was asked some questions I wasn't really ready for. Mm-hmm. And I didn't answer in the best way that I could have. And I walked out of that defense interview feeling like, you know, 2 inches tall and not that great, vowing to get training in the area that I had, but I felt like I didn't really do that great in. And I do a lot of cell phone analysis. And so that was, I didn't do as well as I wanted. And I said, I need to, you know, if I'm going to talk about this, I need to be an expert in this. And I should probably start with some basic training in this. And so that sort of started that path for me. And so since then, I've been able to, I feel a lot more confident. I figured out how I can, you know, talk and speak coherently on a topic. And I think I still make mistakes. I think I still am not as perfect as I want to be, but I do my best, and I do a lot of studying before I testify. So I think that's the other big thing is, you know, it is a test, and make sure you know the case and what you did. Because, you know, at this point in your career, you've read a lot of reports and you do a lot of products and you support a lot of cases, and it all blends together. And I forget what I do. I often forget what it is. And so, you know, figuring out how to remember what you do, document what you do, and be able to recall it. And, you know, I think those are the things, is it's testifying is a test. And so making sure that you're ready for it. You're ready for that final exam.
It's also very helpful to get other people's perspective as well, because I think in your own mind, you can study and prepare for every question that you can think of that they may ask you. But there's a limitation in terms of how many questions that you can come up with. I would advise people to talk with various people who are familiar with the case or what you're testifying over, to get their perspective and to get their angle to see what questions they would ask. You certainly come up with stuff that you wouldn't think about and therefore are not going to study.
That's great advice. Absolutely. And that, yeah, I always take up, you know, I try and read as much of the case as possible, or at least review everything that I wrote, you know, because sometimes I often have to testify for cell phone stuff. So sometimes it's a very, very small bit of the case, but I always try and understand exactly, you know, kind of the overall flavor of the case, because if I didn't have anything to do with that part of the case, it's very easy to say, you know, I didn't do anything with that part of the case, and then they move on.
So. Now, some folks that I've had on the show have told me that, yeah, they testified regarding cell phone analysis. It was just data that they were presenting, so they did not get much questioning by the defense. What were some questions that you got from the defense on your cell phone work?
You know, very much the same thing. It was when during actual trial, it's always pretty much boils down to the data and, you know, just the interpretation of the data. And in the defense interviews, they often ask questions around like some of the geometric questions around cell phone analysis and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So there it's a little more freewheeling in some of the defense interviews. And I think that's where, you know, for me, that was always a struggle because I'm not brilliant at geometry. And I walk out of there going, how did I get into this? But it's, you know, I've learned, you know, over time through practice and work, you know, that what cell phone is and how I can talk to it in a coherent way. And so, but most of it's always about the data, you know, it's, you know, was this phone active there? So it's very much a regurgitation of the data and your findings, and they don't go too far afield in when you're actually testifying, I found.
So what were some of the cell phone analysis training that you took?
I've taken a ton of training through GeoTime. That's the one I've used the most. That's the product that I use. And they've just, you know, the thing I like about that is I know exactly what happens to the data. So I know, I see how the data starts. I know what their processes are, and I know how it comes out on the other end. So I'm able to QA it a lot. And so I'm able to really understand everything that happens. And so all of my training is through them. And I think before them, I took another one that was just kind of like cell phone analysis 101 kind of thing. So, but that's been my go-to. GeoTime's definitely been my go-to for cell phone stuff.
Okay. Do you have any other training that you would recommend?
You know, some of the best training I've had is through IACA and like the beginning. I think we still have a lot of those trainings and like the tactical analysis. That's a great one. I also, you know, those were the mapping one was another one because it opened my eyes. Like when I think about that were really sort of trainings that I took that were really fundamental in shaping my abilities. And those were just like skill stuff, right? As an analyst, the best tool, no matter what sort of tools you use, whether you use GeoTime, Analyst Notebook, you know, or whatever kind of fancy tools, the best thing that you can do as an analyst is hone your thinking skills, right? Because it doesn't matter how many fancy dancy things it is, what they're hiring you for, what they have you for, is your mind and your ability to think and your ability to communicate clearly. So another really hard training I think everybody should take is training in critical thinking. So whenever there's a class on critical thinking and sort of fallacies and biases and that ability to be a really good analyst, I think those are the trainings I think we need to have more of, and that go along with and hand in hand with, you know, how to use the fancy latest whiz bang product that they want to give us. But mostly I think training in thinking and critical thinking is some of the most important training we can take.
So let's do a little exercise here. I want you to pretend that you are putting together a law enforcement unit. It's a mixture of crime analysis and intelligence analysts. You're building this unit. What are some must-haves?
Must-haves, I think, are figuring out the person who loves building the dashboards and the data and knowing how to make that data come to life for the commanders and the people who are going to ask. Because I think that there's a lot of busy work in that. And it's not busy work if it's stuff that you love. And it's critical work, right? I shouldn't call it busy work actually. Mm-hmm. But it's work that's important and that it's what makes a law enforcement agency tick, right? Especially in this data-driven world. So having somebody who's like, yep, sign me up. I want to know how all of this data comes in. I'm the person that has all those great relationships with records. I want to know how NIBRS is. I want to be able to pull it from other agencies. I want to see how we compare to other agencies and really feed that piece of that analytical pie. And so having somebody who is really focused on that and the numbers and that admin analysis and can then say, hey, Shauna, hey, Jason, motor vehicle prowls are skyrocketing. What do you see with that? And then, oh, you know, actually I'm seeing them here. And now I can start looking at that data in this very tactical way and really digging into the case reports and really understanding what is driving the map and what is driving the times and the dates and stuff like that. So now you have somebody who's really sort of saying, yeah, I love doing the tactical stuff. So building that unit to play to the strengths of the people in that unit, as well as recognizing the needs of the department. I know sometimes we divide it up by, you know, I do all the burglaries and you do all the major crimes, and that works too. But, you know, I think I sort of find that what works for me is having those other pieces. And also, I'm versed enough in the data that I can have really meaningful conversations with my data analyst, and we can really walk through, you know, she'll write up a report, or that, you know, or in an agency, you know, they'll write up a report about, you know, the impact of a particular change, and then say, well, is that true or not? Because you have a different feel for the data, because it's a very qualitative sense. So it's building in those strengths for the quantitative and the qualitative, so that you can give the whole story, because the whole story is not in just the numbers, and the whole story is not in just, you know, what's written in the police reports. It's a combination of the two. And it's and furthermore, it's a combination of reaching out and seeing what does the community experiencing, right? If the community is feeling a certain way, why are they feeling a certain way? You know, how is it that you can do that? So making sure that you have all of those pieces together in your crime analysis unit. And so, you know, how do you get the intel analyst in there saying, you know what, I love doing the link charts and I want to identify the organization. And so now you're having both, right? You're able to really dig into the tactics, you really know what the numbers are, and you have your intel analyst kind of putting all of those pieces together so that we have targeted efficient response to whatever problem may be plaguing the community. And I think to me, that's the ideal.
All right, let's finish up with personal interest now. And so I'm laughing because of your answer when I asked this in the prep call, and you said, well, you might think I'm 80, but I like Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune. My first question is, which do you like better?
Jeopardy, of course. Okay. I'm terrible at it.
So let me ask you this then, because they're considered sibling shows. So you can only be on one or the other. So people that are on Wheel of Fortune can't be on Jeopardy and vice versa. So if you had the opportunity, which one would you be on, Jeopardy or Wheel of Fortune?
Oh, you're asking me, it's like, I will be on Wheel of Fortune because you make way more money, but I will watch Jeopardy religiously. So it actually comes back to my grandmother, you know, who kept me during my various things. That's what she did every night. We'd sit down and have dinner, and from 7 to 8, it was religious Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune. And so I find it this very comforting thing. And she would laugh and she would tell me these stories about, you know, Pat Sajak, who's very entertaining and he's very funny. And she's like, oh, he's so funny. And then when Alex, rest his soul, you know, he's like, he just can't make a joke. And so I just, you know, every time I watch them, you know, she sits beside me and I just kind of laugh. And it's just it's a very nice way for me to remember my grandmother. But, you know, now with all of the drama, now that Alex has passed and we have, you know, it's renewed my interest in it. And I think Milam is doing a great job. That's how you pronounce your name.
I think that's it. I don't know any better. So we're just going to go with it. And so I was going to ask you about that, because there was quite a big deal there for a while, like what they were going to do. And then the one guy that was in charge of coming up with a new host decided to put himself in that position. And then everybody seemed to not like that, so he stepped down. So is it just her now doing the hosting?
I think she's got a temporary gig, right? It's the pilot. So, you know, I don't know what they're going to do with it. I think she's doing a great job. I think, yeah, it was so much drama, but it was nice to have that drama versus all the other drama out in the universe. You're like, oh my God, the Jeopardy drama, and everybody being all excited about it.
You know, I don't really have a dog in a fight. I don't watch the show, but I wish they would actually find somebody's the host name that's Alex. So all the pop culture references, you could still, I'll take that for 100, Alex, and people will know what you're talking about forever, you know, or at least.
No, we thinking. Can't do that.
Yeah,
there's
can't.
Only one Alex.
Because someday, you know, very soon, someone's not going to know that Alex Trebek was the host of Jeopardy.
Right? That will be a sad day.
Yeah.
That will be a very sad day.
That is coming. And it's funny. My wife is way smarter than me. I was told the kids that. So watching with her Jeopardy, she gets like half the answers. Like she knows like half the answers on the board. And I will be lucky if I get three of them right in a whole screen. I don't know about you, but
I don't do that well.
Yeah.
But I love it. I always feel like I should walk away knowing everything. Like my mom was great at just knowing just random factoids.
Yes. And
so if you follow it much, Matt Imodio, he was the guy, he was like now the second most winningest guy. He was this PhD student at Yale, and he won like, I don't know, I think he like did a winning streak of like 30 or 40 recently, and he'd like millions of dollars, you know, which is just insane. It's just crazy to me. And I think, how on earth does he know all of that? And some of the questions, you're like, how on earth does a human learn that piece of knowledge? But apparently there's, you know, all sorts of crazy, you know, study things that you can do out there to when you're prepping to be on Jeopardy. And that's why I won't pick Jeopardy, is because I'm so bad at standardized testing. So that's why I always, Wheel of Fortune was an easy question for me.
Yeah, and it's funny now that there's all the analytics, right? It was sports and all this other stuff. Now there's a trick to everything. Right.
Yes.
You can do these little tricks to get better on the SATs. You can do this little tricks to get on Jeopardy and all this other stuff. I was actually really disappointed when I realized Rubik's Cube could be solved by just doing certain steps right in a row. And I'm like, oh, well, that kind of takes the fun out of it now. I just thought it was just some random thing that you can do. And then once I saw that, you know, a computer can solve it in 5 seconds, it's just like, oh, it's no longer really all that fun. So the fact that there's analytics involved, and not just that you're naturally smart, you're actually studying to be better for the show, it kind of takes out the fun a little bit for me.
Yeah, when I heard about that one, I think it was the guy before Matt Imodio, it was the guy who quote unquote broke Jeopardy. And because he was the one that went, he realized that if he did all of the high end ones, like everything for 1,000 and then sort of picked around for the daily double, that he could just boost his score so high. They were like looking at how he bet, and they realized that he, you know, kind of broke the algorithm. And so, yeah, it did kind of take the fun out of it. So I do go back and forth on watching Jeopardy. Like I'll binge it for a couple months and then I stop, and then I binge it for a couple months. But I see, I thought you were going to say about the Rubik's Cube, just take the stickers off. Cause you know,
that's what we did when we were kids. Now they actually set up like scanners and optics, an iPhone, and it solves it in 5 seconds. But no, yeah, that's what we did when we were kids, right? We took off the stickers.
Yeah. So I don't read the end of the chapter. I try not ever, even if I think I know who the who the killer is, if I'm reading a book or who, you know, the whodunit, I refuse to like guess. Like it's just not, like I don't want to know, even if I think I'm right. Like I just have never been that person. I'm like, I don't want to know who did it. And I'm like, oh, it's obvious. And I'm like, no, it's not. I'm not going to answer it. I don't know who it is. So I always turn that piece of my brain off.
All right. Well, our last segment to the show is Words to the World. And this is when I give the guests the last word. Shauna, you can promote any idea that you wish. What are your words to the world?
So they're not my words, they're Shakespeare's. So this above all else, be to thine own self, be true. Be true to yourself. That's the most important part. The other one comes from a good friend of mine when I was doing a PhD, and he said, don't worry, life is long and full of surprises. And indeed it is. And so as we go through this world, remember that life is long and full of surprises, and always follow your heart and you'll get where you're supposed to be.
Very good. Why leave every guest with you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later?
I hope not. Well, thanks. We'll do all those pieces.
But I do appreciate you being on the show, Shauna. Thank you so much, and you be safe.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcast.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also, thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Alder and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.